Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Book Goodies, the podcast for authors by authors. I'm your host, Deborah Carney, and my co-host today is...
Karen Garcia. How are you doing today?
We're doing great. And today we are joined by author Sonia Pressman Fuentes. Hi, Sonia. How are you?
Hi, Deborah. I'm fine. How are you?
We're all great. We're hoping for the humidity to break, and we're breaking into fall now. So the hot, humid summer, although we love summer, it's starting to break a little bit. So we have that nice early fall weather. Sonia, why don't you take a minute and introduce yourself to our listeners so that they know a little bit about you before we start talking about your book?
Well, as you heard, my name is Sonia Pressman Fuentes. I am a feminist activist, an author, a public speaker, and a lawyer. I live in Sarasota, Florida.
That's awesome. We love talking to female activists. You are the people that make the world go round and get us into better places, since, you know, you've got three females that are pretty independent on the call, but I know that there still is a lot of feminists out there that are helping us get more recognition and rights, I guess we could say. So, Sonia, why don't you tell us, you wrote a memoir, why don't you tell us a bit about your memoir?
Well, my memoir begins with my parents' marriage in a village in Poland in 1913, and then they moved right away to Germany because my father had already left Poland when he was a teenager for Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And then, by the way, my memoir is written with humor.
Good. We love humor.
And then... I was born in Berlin. I had a brother who was 14 years my senior. And we fled Germany in 1933 due to the Nazi regime.
Right.
And we went initially to Antwerp, Belgium, where we remained for 9 months. And then we took a ship to the United States and arrived here on April 1st, 1934. And I subsequently became an attorney, a founder of the second wave of the women's movement. And I wrote my memoir to memorialize my parents' lives, my own life, and to get the facts down about how the women's movement began.
I love that. That sounds like you've been very active through your entire life, and I was actually going to ask if you, when you said when you were born and you were living in Germany, I was going to ask if you got out, and I'm glad you were able to say yes, because that was a very scary time. Does your memoir cover any of that time in any depth, like being, you know, why you had to leave and how you got out and all that, or is it more focused after you got to the United States?
My memoir covers everything from the time my parents got married until I returned to Berlin in 1978.
Wow. Awesome. What I like to call, and I'm sure you do too, your memoir is actually a slice of history. And that is something that I'm really excited that people are writing, because, you know, all we know are, you know, other than like the Anne Frank or, you know, some other maybe
personal accounts.
You know, you're actually putting it in a time frame of a lifetime, which is very important for people to be able to identify with.
Well, one of the reasons I did it was that men who worked at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where I worked, who were initially very opposed to enforcing the law that prohibits employment discrimination based on women, when they saw the way the wind was blowing, they not only changed their positions, but began to say that they had been like that all along. So I said to a friend of mine, I'm going to have to write down what happened so that the stories these men are telling don't become accepted. And that was one of the reasons I wrote the book.
And that, again, you know, personal history and personal memoirs and personal accounts of actually what happened are so much more powerful than, you know, reading in a textbook. Sonia Fuentes, you know, she founded the Second Women's Movement and yada, yada, yada. And it's one line in the textbook where you have an entire book where you can explain about it. Karen, do you have any questions?
Well, I don't think we've actually mentioned the name of your book. It's Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, correct?
And the subtitle is The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter.
That's awesome. So, well, I have to ask about the title because it is such a compelling title. Can you tell us how that happened? Is there a story around that?
There is a story around that. As I said, the book was written with humor, and the title is humorous, and it comes from something that my mother said to me. My mother kept a kosher home, and she cooked for herself and my father and me, always buying, of course, fresh products and cooking with love. And I always ate at home. My parents did not come from an era and a time and a culture where you went out to restaurants. But as I became a teenager, I began to get invitations for meals at the home of friends or at restaurants. And this made my mother very uncomfortable because she felt that she didn't know what kind of food I'd be getting if I went out. And so she wanted me to eat a complete meal home before I went out to eat that meal.
Nice.
And she would say to me when I was on my way out to dinner, eat first, you don't know what they'll give you.
That's awesome.
Oh my gosh, I'm having flashbacks of talking with my own grandmother.
Nice.
about similar things, you know, and it wasn't the whole full meal thing, but you know, that kind of generational, you know, kind of restaurants weren't a big thing. So, you know, staying home and eating at home. And then also, you know, of course, I can't tell you the number of times she used the ubiquitous line on me of, you know, eat, you know, finish your food because there are children starving in Europe.
We all heard that too.
Yeah, I heard that a ton as a kid. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Well, I'll say something else, a meal very appetizing. If you don't eat it, I'll just have to throw it in the garbage.
Don't waste food. It's too precious. But,
oh my gosh.
And Sonia, you lived through the Depression and everything, so you know that, you know, food was very precious, a very big commodity. And even though we ended up with, you know, some pretty overweight people that had to grow up with the eat, clean your plate or else, it was a sign of the times, basically. It was, you know, people were like, you know, you're lucky to have food, eat what you have. So,
well, let me say a couple of things about that. First of all, my book has not, except for this story, my book has nothing to do with food or eating.
Okay.
But there have been times when I was selling the book where people would say to me, thanks a lot, but I have enough cookbooks already.
We'll
dispel that.
There's something I wanted to say was that people often ask me about the Depression because we arrived here in 1934.
Right.
But I must tell you that I never knew anything about the Depression growing up. I never heard it mentioned in my home. I don't know anything about it other than when I grew up, I, of course, read about the Depression. But my family didn't experience it, and I never heard it mentioned.
Okay.
That's pretty awesome, too, because that shows that what we here think is something as, you know, huge, you know, the way you were raised, it was not an issue that was discussed in your house. It was, you know, your life was fine just the way it was.
Well, it was a huge thing in this country, but my father was always in business for himself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he wasn't working for a company or anybody else. And I grew up in the Catskill Mountains of New York.
Oh, beautiful.
And the people that I knew were all in the summer resort business, as my parents were. And I just never heard anything about it.
That's incredible.
That is incredible. I'm really excited. Now, what triggered you to write your memoir, other than the gentleman saying that there's never been discrimination?
Well, I think there were two other things. First, I knew that I played a historic role with regard to being a co-founder of the second wave of the women's movement, and I wanted to get that history down. And secondly, I felt that my parents' lives were of a kind that was disappearing. They grew up, as I mentioned, in a small village in Poland, and they lived a traditional Jewish life, and Hitler, by and large, killed most of the people who lived in those villages and lived those kinds of lives. Those kinds of lives were passing from the scene. And my parents, as many parents are to their children, were bigger than life to me. And I wanted to get their life down, too.
And I think that, again, a great slice of history and a great memorial to...
That's a lovely tribute, yeah.
A great tribute. Now, when you started to write it, you had in mind the things that you wanted to say. Did you start with a timeline, or did you just start writing stories and then put them in a timeline later?
Well, I had been telling and writing stories all my life. I'm a storyteller. And so I already had a good many of the stories written down. But I had to rewrite them considerably for the book. I had to put them in some kind of order. I had to add other things, other stories to them. And so it was, the whole process took me 5.5 years. And I also had to, what's the word I'm looking for, research the facts.
Right.
When I started to write, you would think if you're writing a memoir, you don't have to look anything up because you lived it. But that is totally not the case if you have a commitment to the truth, because just about every word that I wrote, I wanted to verify that my recollection was correct, or I needed some additional facts or something. So I did a great deal of research in addition to the writing.
And we've heard that a lot from some other memoir authors that do time period ones, and it lends to the authenticity and the credibility of your book. And like you said, I can remember things, but I may not know exactly what year those were until I tie it to an event, and then I look up when that event occurred.
You know,
a political event or a speech by a politician or a particular TV show or... even music, you know, you can remember the first time you heard a song play, and you need to go back and look up when that was in order to keep your timeline tidy and to be accurate. And in your case, you've been such a big part of history. Yes, you did all this stuff, but you may not even remember what was the date that you made your first speech, or what was the date that you addressed a certain group of people that you wanted to mention. So you could go back and look at your news clippings and also do, you know, your research. And I'm sure the internet helped out quite a bit, but I'm also sure you probably spent a lot of time in the library.
Not so much in the library, some, because I'm a computer addict.
Okay.
And a lot of information is on the computer. In some cases, I wrote to people. And also, I had a wonderful resource in my late brother, who was alive at that time, because, as I said, the book starts with my parents' wedding and goes on to their lives in Germany, and I was a child at that time, or not even born yet.
Right.
But my brother was born a year after my parents got married, so I used to call him all the time and ask him, what about this, Herman, what about that, and he would... tell me all about things that I had not myself witnessed or where I needed more information.
And that in your case, it's really awesome that you had a brother that was that much older than you, because it was a very tumultuous time, and he was going through all this stuff with your parents before you were, like you said, before you were even born.
And I also had another resource from my brother. After we lived in the United States many years, he once opened his night table drawer and found a diary that he had started keeping in German shorthand in 1932 when the Nazis began coming into power.
Wow.
And he kept it until sometime in 1935 when we were living in the Bronx. And it took me about 10 years, and I got my brother to, working with his granddaughter, they transcribed it into English.
Wow.
And I have a copy, and there's a copy in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and his children have copies. So that was also a wonderful resource for me.
Wow, I'd actually like to read that. You should publish that on his behalf.
It's available online.
Is it really? Okay, we need the link
to that. Fantastic, definitely. Oh,
that's
incredible.
I don't think there's a link. I think I can send it to you or something, but I will send it to you.
Okay, awesome. Because that is, again, it's a firsthand account of the things that were going on from someone who was, you know, not necessarily old, but was old enough to be able to recount those activities and those historical facts that makes it more real to people other than, again, you know, a couple lines in a...
Well, there's more than a couple lines, but
about a particular, you know,
event, right?
Event.
Well, and something like that, especially since he was younger at the time, to have
he was about 19 at the time.
Yeah, to have a perspective of someone who's just, you know, on that adulthood cusp.
He went out with this girl, he went to the you know, but in between is stuff about the Nazis.
Right.
Well, and he was of an age to be drafted into the army.
I never heard him talk. You're talking about in the United States or in Germany?
In Germany.
I never heard him mention that. We're talking 1933, 34. I don't know that they had a draft at that time. But I've never heard any mention of that.
That's
good. I think that was later.
Well, I'm glad he avoided it in any case. So now, how were some of the ways that you were able to trigger? I mean, you've got some really strong memories and a lot of public documentation of your life. How did you trigger some of your other memories other than talking to your brother?
Well, I didn't have to trigger memories.
Mm-hmm.
Had the memories. What I had to do was I had a lot of papers on my early days at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I had those documents. I was in touch with other feminists, in particular my friend Mary Eastwood, who was the co-founder of NOW, as I was, so I would talk with her, and I learned from her things that I didn't know, that I wasn't present on. So I just did everything and anything that occurred to me.
You've got so much rich history. And, you know, I mean, we're looking at your Wikipedia page, which sorely needs updating because, you know.
That's nothing. You got to go to my website.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, definitely.
You know, because your
thing is on my website.
Yeah, and why don't you, if we can, you know, digress a little bit, can you tell us what it was like to, what spurred you to form start the feminist movement? What were your, how did you get that started?
Okay, well, I was working as a lawyer in a new agency called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And that agency opened for business on July 2nd, 1965. And I joined it on October 4th, 1965, 3 months after it opened. And I was the first woman attorney in its office at the General Counsel. And that agency was created to enforce a new law called Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that law prohibited and prohibits discrimination based in employment by employers, employment agencies, and labor unions based on race, religion, color, sex, and national origin. Now it also includes disability, either mental or physical disability, but at that time it didn't. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, during the first year or the first year and a half of that agency's existence, and it had about 100 permanent employees, and most of them had come there to work in the field of race discrimination. And the sex discrimination prohibition only came in towards the latter stage of the debates on the statute. And nobody really expected that sex discrimination would be a part of this act.
Wow.
And the first year or year and a half, the people there didn't want to spend the commission's time and money dealing with the issues of gender discrimination. And also, the issues of gender discrimination were much more difficult. With regard to race discrimination of color, it was black and white. You simply couldn't discriminate on the basis of race, and there was nothing to talk about by and large. But with regard to gender discrimination, all kinds of issues were raised, and the people at the commission didn't know how to resolve them. So I got increasingly frustrated when I saw that issues of discrimination against women were not being dealt with. And while I was feeling this way, a woman writer came into our offices. She had written a book that was published in 1963, which revolutionized this country. Her name was Betty Friedan, and her book was called The Feminine Mystique.
Yep.
So that was published in 1963, and she thought she was going to publish a second book about all the progress women had made since her book was published. So she came into the offices of the general counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to interview the general counsel and his deputy. But she saw me standing there, a woman. So she came over to me and said, "What are the problems here? What are the conflicts? What's wrong?" And initially, I felt that if I told her what was going on, I might lose my job.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
So I told her nothing. I said, "Everything's just fine here." So then she came back 2 weeks later, and she saw me again, and she asked me the same question again. And she happened to catch me at a time when I was feeling particularly frustrated at the commission's failure to implement the law for women. Mm. So I invited her into the privacy of my office, and I told her how frustrated I was, and I got tears in my eyes, and I told her that what this country needs is an organization to fight for women like the NAACP fought for its constituency.
Right.
And that was either in the latter part of 65 or the early part of 66. And then at two meetings in June of 1966 and in October of 1966, the National Organization for Women was formed.
That is awesome. That is such a big event for women. You know, that was such a... It leaves me speechless that, you know, how these... You don't think about how the organization was formed. You just know, oh, somebody formed the organization. And, you know, it helped with women's rights, and you don't think about the actual people that went about getting it running, who formed it and started working for women's rights. And you being a lawyer, perfect. Her being a writer, perfect. You know, you could communicate, and you could communicate accurately, and you could quote the legal stuff without having to go out to someone else. So that is, to me, that's extremely fascinating. And then the second organization was that born out of the
Second organization?
The I lost my. Let me go look at the page again. The Federally Employed Women.
Oh yeah, that was another organization. What happened there was, I think that was later, but I'm not sure. I'd have to look up my records. But there was a course given in Washington, D.C., I think by the Department of Agriculture, and they decided to give a course for women in the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I took that, and other women took that, and I was taught by a woman named Helen Dudley. And we liked that course, and when the course was ending, we did not want to just go our separate ways. So we decided to form an organization to fight for women's rights in the federal government. And we called it FEW, which stands for Federally Employed Women, but also let you know that there were FEW federally employed women who were getting promoted and getting the higher jobs the way the men did. So that word FEW had a couple of meanings.
I see that. So you're really good with wordplay, and you're really good with, you know, double entendre, and, you know, obviously you've made a huge difference in women's rights throughout the years, and I see that you were also...
I came up with the name for NOW or the name for FEW. I did not.
Okay.
The organizations did.
Right. But you were part of the organization, did you?
I was, and you might be interested in the following. In 2009 and 2010, I decided to do some research on the founders of NOW because nobody really knew who all of them were.
Right.
And how many there were and where they were and how many were alive. So I did that research, and then this past July, and I published an article about it, and this past July I updated it. So you might be interested to know that there were 49 founders of NOW, men and women.
Wow.
And those 49, to my knowledge, 9 of us are surviving today.
Wow.
Wow. My goodness. Well, I'm definitely glad that you know you're talking with us today, because it is a really important part of our not only our nation's history, but as women in the workplace, an important part of why we're here. And I think that it's not always well told in the school system, or you know, in our educational facilities in general, and a lot of it has passed out of public knowledge. And it's important to remember where we came from, so we can figure out where we're going.
That's terrific. I agree with you wholeheartedly, of course.
And it's also important to know about the people who started the movements, and that, indeed, for our daughters to be where they are now, it's because someone else, you know, fought for that. And someone else organized and got together and told our government and, you know, whoever, that women are as equally important as men. There, you know, there should be equal. There should be no one or the other
differentiation.
Yeah, there should be no other differentiation. And
well, we always say that we stand on the shoulders of those who came before.
Exactly. And
but occasionally we should still look down and see whose shoulders we're standing upon.
Exactly. There. Yeah, that's what I was searching for. You know, I mean, in my life, my father always would tell me, you can do whatever you want to do. Don't let anybody ever, you know, say you can't do something because you're a girl. And one of the things that Karen and I are involved in, we're involved in an industry that has a lot of very strong-willed female executives. And a lot of female company owners. And for some reason, it came up a few months ago that, you know, somebody was saying that there were no successful women in our industry.
And we all just sat back and laughed.
And we're like, who do you talk to? And, you know, and then we countered with, you know, these are all the successful women that, you know, that we can count on. You know, we'll make a top 25 for you, but, you know, there are hundreds of successful women in our industry. But to know that that thought pattern still exists in some man's mind is disturbing. You know,
well, not just men, there are women too.
Yes, yeah. Yes, there are women that also think that now, you know, I'm perfectly happy at home. I don't need any rights. Just leave me alone. And, you know, that's fine for them to have that attitude. But for the women that want to be out there, there shouldn't be any way that anyone can stop them, and they shouldn't be qualified by, oh, how did you have a successful business? You must be ignoring your family, which came up recently in a debate that we were that we experienced, that, you know, made one of our panelists go ballistic. So, you know, it becomes not only women in the workplace, but women in the home. And, you know, why is it just the woman's job to raise the kids and cook the meals and clean the house? So that's one of the things that is still being worked out.
It's an antiquated mindset, you know, in all honesty. I mean, my husband and I, we both work from home. We both take care of the kids in you know, in equal fashion. And we're both successful in what we do. And for us, it is a partnership. And I think that people lose sight of, you know, one or the other. You know, I hear the conversation a lot about, well, you know, if you have a job outside of the house, then you're, you know, ignoring your kids. If you're home, you're not supporting the family, whatever. That's ridiculous, because, you know, women should have a choice. If you would like to stay home, then you should have the choice to stay home. If
exactly
you want
right.
to be in the workplace, you should have, you know, the choice to be in the workplace. And nobody else, regardless of gender, should make you feel inferior for what you have chosen for yourself. Because it is your choice about your happiness, about your life, and no one else has the right to tell you you're doing it wrong.
And part of the reason that we can make that statement is because of you and the 49 other people that co-founded the National Organization for Women.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's just phenomenal to me, the amount of history that just our lifetimes and... I mean, you're a wonderful example of an activist that has been successful and has helped change our society. And that is just something that is, people think that one person can't make a difference. And what you have done is shown that one person plus one person plus one person plus one person can make a difference. It's not you all by yourself, but it's you coordinating with other women. And then every time you made a speech or you had a talk or you wrote an article, it was part of the groundswell. And without your voice, it wouldn't have been what it was.
Well, I didn't, you don't leave me anything left to say because you're saying it beautifully yourself.
We want to make sure that our listeners understand who we're talking to and how important your memoir is. And, you know, I do want to talk, I don't want to just, you know, throw accolades at you, but I want people who are listening to understand that one of the reasons that any memoir is important and yours, you know, even more important is that you take a slice of history and you humanize it, you know, and the particular part of history that you've been involved in has impacted in generations, you know, and you didn't come from a big wealthy family. You know, you came from a family that escaped the Nazis. You came from a family that didn't have the greatest of beginnings and the easiest life. And instead of you saying, oh, poor me, you're like, hey, something's wrong here. Let's take care of it. And because you left Germany, your family left and brought you to the United States, gave you the freedom to be able to do what you did in your future.
All of that is true. I wanted to make one comment where you had said that your father told you you could be anything you wanted to. My father and mother told me that I should not get an education, not have a career, but that I needed to get married at the age of 18, learn how to cook and sew and raise a family.
Yep.
Because that's what they knew, but I must also add that when I totally ignored their advice and went to college and law school, my parents paid for it, and moved from Long Island to North Miami Beach, Florida, so that I could live with them while I was attending law school, which they didn't want me to attend.
But you still had their support, which is awesome. And that is something that I think another thing that a lot of people don't understand is that, you know, even when a child is rebellious, that their family can still support them. They can be not happy about it, but they can still support them. And look what you were able to do because your parents, you know, made that move and made it possible for you to go to college and become a lawyer.
But I got to tell you, I've never understood it myself. Because when I was raising my daughter, I said to her, Zia, if you do something that I approve of, I'll pay for it or help you or whatever. But if you want to do something that's totally off the wall, I won't. But my parents didn't do that.
Yeah.
I have to give them so much credit for that. I've never understood it.
Yep. Well, and it's because, you know,
I do understand it. They loved me very much. And if there was something that I wanted to do, they were going to support me, just as you said.
Well, and they could probably see that there was something a little bit different in you and that you didn't want to live.
No. They just loved me.
Well, we're glad.
But they didn't see anything different in me.
Yeah.
To them, I was their daughter, and they loved me. But I was just a young woman like anybody else. And what they knew was the young women are supposed to get married and have a family.
Right.
Well, it's societal norm, definitely. So you hadn't gotten around to changing that yet. So let's going back to the book. When you started writing, was it your intention to make a humorous memoir about your family, or did you intend to be more of a factual historical statement?
Well, there's a story to that too. First of all, I am a person known for her sense of humor, and I used humor all my life in storytelling and so on. So I don't think I sat down and said, should this be humorous or not? But I did have a lot of problems when I wrote the book because it contains stories that are humorous and stories that are serious. Mm-hmm. And I had never written a book before, and I didn't know whether you could do that in a book. And that worried me all the time. And I didn't realize that life is humorous and serious.
Yes.
And all our lives combine those things. But I was very worried about that. But once the book was published, it was never a problem.
Well, and you wrote it the way you write your... I mean, you've been a writer, like you said. You've always been a storyteller. You've written numerous articles. You speak, you know, all over the world. And all you had to do was bring those all together. And I'm sure you had serious and humor in your speeches and in your articles throughout the years. And you just didn't realize it.
Well, I realize that I use humor in my speeches and articles. It depends. Some of them are just serious.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my speeches are serious. But when I do readings from my memoir, then, of course, it's humorous. So it's a mixture.
Mm-hmm. And when you went to, you know, once you had your manuscript finished and you went to publish, can you walk us through, you know, what your experience was with, you know, did you find an agent? Did you use a small press? Did you self-publish? Tell us more about that process for you.
An article published, it's on my website, and it's called How I Published My Memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was a very difficult process for me, never having done anything like it before. I tried initially to get a traditional publisher, and I stopped keeping track of the letters I wrote to publishers when it reached 100.
Oh, my.
After that, I no longer kept track. And so I never was able to get a traditional publisher. Then I tried to get an agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I never found... At one point, I did find a publisher, a small publishing company, and a woman who was out... She was out west. And she had a very poorly written contract that she claimed was written by the best lawyer in Arizona or some such thing. And so I spent 3 months rewriting a contract. And I was about to sign it when I saw a clause there that said that if anybody ever sues her in connection with my book, that she would have the right to litigate it. She would not consult me on it, and that if she lost the case and had to pay damages, I would be responsible.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I've seen that clause in other contracts in the literary world. So I said to her, well, how could I sign such a thing? How, if I'm not involved in the litigation, and then I'm responsible for any claim, that that doesn't make sense. I said, I could be responsible for $10 million. So that was the end of that deal. And then I never really found an agent that I was happy with. And so I ended up going with a company, and I've been very happy with them, called Ex Libris, X-L-I-B-R-I-S. Mm-hmm. And I self-published the book with Ex Libris.
Nice. And they are a very reputable, very... they're a company that a lot of people use for self-publishing, and I'm glad that you found a good fit with them.
Well, they weren't the first one.
Right.
I had another company first. And I had something like 8 speaking engagements lined up in Sarasota, Florida, where I live, and elsewhere, whatever. I had about 8. And that earlier publisher said, they're sorry, they can't meet the commitment. The book won't be ready.
Ah!
And I didn't know what I was going to do. And then I found Ex Libris, and I've had an excellent relationship with them ever since. The book is published in hard copy, soft copy, and... on Kindle.
Beautiful. Put it out there in all the different ways that people want to have mm-hmm. available to them, depending on their preference.
Now, you said that this particular memoir goes up to 1978 when you returned to Berlin. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Are you considering writing a follow-up to that? Of
No, but I write articles all the time.
Oh, okay. Great.
And they generally get published, and many of them are on my website.
Okay. Good. So the second edition is your website. Can you tell us your website address?
Absolutely. It's http://www.erraticimpact, and that's spelled erraticimpact.com/ my last name. FUENTES. So it's www.erraticimpact.com. Fuentes.
Nice.
Fantastic. And we'll make sure that we, you know, also put that website URL with the podcast on our site as well, so people can just click the link. They don't have to go and type it and figure out what they did wrong.
Weird website, but I have a wonderful webmaster. And that website, that URL is his.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Yep, I'm actually on that. I've been on that for a while, and he's got / feminism, and it has a lot of really great information about you, so we will certainly highlight that. And
I don't think feminism is not part of my website, of the URL of my website, but my webmaster is a feminist.
Right.
And he has a broader website, and my website is a part of his website.
Okay.
But my website doesn't have the word feminism in it.
Okay.
I don't think so. I'm looking it up here just to be sure I got it right.
No, it's okay. You can type it in the way you said it, and then it forwards to...
tildefeminism/HTML.
Yeah.
It's all
that
good.
That may be his website, but my website doesn't have
correct.
That word
okay.
in.
Yep, you're good. So, we're all good.
Yeah, and there's tons of information, and it looks like there's several book excerpts and a bunch of reviews and more stories and photos. This is fantastic.
Well, this guy's been keeping it for me, and he volunteered to create it and maintain it, and that's what he does.
That's awesome.
That's wonderful.
Terrific guy.
Well, and it's always nice to have, because authors do need websites, and particularly you, that you keep, you know, writing articles and that you do still do speeches. It's great that you have that presence on the internet so that people can find out about you without having to dig too far.
And, it's invaluable.
Yep. And with such a rich history, and I know we haven't talked all that much about the actual, we've talked a little bit about the actual creation of the book, but because it's so historically important, we've talked more about that. What kind of advice would you give to someone who was going to sit down and write a memoir?
Well, I never like giving advice to people in general or even specifically, but excuse me. One of the things I did while I was writing my memoir was I took a two-week summer course at the University of Iowa on memoir writing.
Mm-hmm.
I was attending an author's group here in Sarasota, and one woman came in one time, and she was so enthusiastic, she said, oh, she just went to this summer program on how to write a memoir at the University of Iowa. And so then I looked into it, and I spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks there, and that was very worthwhile. I also took a course on getting the book published. At that time, I was living in Potomac, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, D.C., and there's a Writer's Center in Bethesda, Maryland, and they have all kinds of courses, and I took one of their courses, and that was helpful to me. There are so many things that are helpful. You know, it's necessary to do research. The more you can educate yourself, if there's a writer's group in your community, go to it, and then just write, and you got to edit. I edited a tremendous amount myself. I had other people edit for me. I mean, I could go on and on as to what you have to do. You need to know English, and that may sound funny, but there are very few people in this country who speak English and write English correctly. And English was my fourth language, but I love English, and I have a few friends that love English with me, but you can count them on the fingers of one hand.
Most
people don't speak or write English correctly, so if you want to be a writer, that's another thing I recommend to you. Learn how to speak and write correct English.
And we've talked to some other folks that have speak multiple languages, and English was not necessarily their first. And they said that that has actually helped them to be a little bit more creative or a little bit look at things in a different way than people who their only language is English. Have you found that, or did you not encounter that?
It doesn't help me to look at things in a different way, but, My Jewish culture helps me to look at things in a different way. But what knowing different languages has done in my case is that I love language. I adore language. And a few years ago, I went to Oxford University, and one of the courses I took there was on the history of English.
Oh, interesting.
I just adore language, and I think that's because I learned different ones when I was a child.
And you've brought up something really interesting, and, you know, you've been around the bus a few times, or around the block a few times, as they call it, and you're still going to courses, and you're still out there educating yourself. And I think that's also something that's so important for not just writers, but for folks in general. Things are always constantly changing, and instead of isolating yourself, you should get out there and, you know, once in a while, take a class somewhere, even if it's just at a local, you know, junior college or something, or an online course to learn and expand your mind just that much more. I mean, English is your fourth language, and just a couple of years ago, you went to Oxford. You know, I mean, that's incredible. A lot of people would just say, I know what I know, and that's all I need to know. And instead, you're still out there researching and digging and learning even more. And your love of language, you know, you command the language very well. So that's intriguing.
I took Latin in high school and college, mm-hmm. and that's a wonderful basis for English. And unfortunately, the schools are not teaching it the way they used to.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, most schools aren't teaching it at all. So.
That's right.
It's such a fabulous foundation for English. But Sarasota, Florida, where I live, is mm-hmm. a very special place with regard to organizations and activities and courses, anything in the world. This is a small town. But anything in the world that you want to study or go to, or the movies or the theater or the lecture or that, is here.
That's awesome.
And this town is full of senior citizens who are very active.
That's
they
fantastic.
They volunteer, they take courses, they do this, they do that. This town, as a matter of fact, could not run if it were not for people volunteering.
And that's important to point out. And you know what? I've been very active in volunteer activities, but I think that senior citizens even more appreciate the idea that they worked for a living and now they're doing what they want to do, and they volunteer for things that they feel need to be done because they know things still need to be done, and there may not be budgets for it, but hey, they've got some free time. Let's do this, and you know, let's be social and let's be active, and you know, let's not be a part of the Florida that's just sitting around looking at the ocean waiting to go on to the next life or whatever. So
I think there is no next life.
That's it.
There you go.
You know, that's the way of looking at it. You know, live it the way you want to live it. So
eat first. You don't know what they'll give you.
Nice. That's nice.
Oh my goodness.
Sonia,
can you tell us more about where people can buy your book?
They have to buy it online.
Mm-hmm.
And they can get it from Amazon.com, exlibris.com, BarnesandNoble.com. And as I said, it's available in hardcover, softcover, and for Kindle.
Fantastic. That's absolutely amazing.
That is amazing. And one last question I want to ask you is about your daughter. You said you have a daughter. Is she a feminist too? Is she following your footsteps, or did she go off and do something totally different?
She is in no way following in my footsteps, but she shares my beliefs in the equality of women,
mm-hmm,
and many of my other beliefs, but she is not an activist.
Okay. She left that to mom, or mom did enough of it. So, it's been a joy talking to you, and I hope many people will go out and buy your book as a result of listening to this. And you also gave our authors that are listening a lot of great tips on, you know, how they should write their own memoir, and maybe you've inspired some to write their memoir so that they can share their slice of history. And I greatly appreciate you taking the time and sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. Karen had already asked where we can find you on the internet. We'll post all of that on a blog post, and that will be put up at BookGoodies, BookGoodies.com, and you'll be able to do a search for Sonia there, and find the show notes where you can find all the links that will get you to her books and to her website, so you can find out even more about her, and you can follow her current article writing and all the wonderful things that she's still sharing, and maybe there'll be a speech that she's giving in your area.
I'm giving my next speech will be at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, on October 24th. I'll be speaking at the law school.
That's fantastic.
I know exactly where that is, and I live just a little too far away to go. New York City to Cornell is a little bit, but I might even have to think about that. So
I'd take the day off.
I'd take the day off and go, yeah.
There'll be a reception after my talk, which is at 4:30, the talk.
Okay.
And the reception will start about 6, and it's open to the public.
Nice.
Fantastic.
That's beautiful.
That's even better.
Well, and as always, we want to thank all of our listeners for listening. And again, go to bookgoodies.com, leave us comments, check out the links at the top of the site where you can promote your books and offer to be a guest on our podcast. And we want to thank geekcast.fm for hosting our podcasts. And thanks again to both Sonia and Karen. And everybody, sit down, get writing, and have a great day.
It's been a pleasure.